Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Live from the Jerome L. Green Performance Space here at WNYC, it's The Brian Lehrer Show. Good morning, everyone in Radioland. Good morning, everyone here in TGS, the Green Space. For those of you who've never seen it, it's our ground floor theater at 160 Varick Street in Lower Manhattan, seven floors below our usual studios. We have 120 seats or so. It's nice and intimate. We have video monitors for multimedia elements. We have a great staff led by Jennifer Sendro putting together great programs from live music and theater to interviews, roundtables, and events. And for 2017, we are doing The Brian Lehrer Show live from the Green Space once a month. So here we are, and welcome to those of you in the physical space, and welcome to those of you in the live radio or time-shifted space. Those of you here in the green space, speak up as we go along today. Raise your hands when our guests are on, and our producers will come around with a microphone, and you can ask a question or make a comment. Listeners, our phones will also remain open as usual at 212-433-WNYC. Now, today is a day when there is so much news in and out of Trump world. A select group of white male Senate Republicans continues to craft a new health care bill behind closed doors. Maybe we should call it stealth care instead of health care. And Democrats continue to raise their voices, but with little parliamentary power to force even a public debate. Here is an extraordinary exchange, if you haven't heard it in the news, between the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday.
Well, we have time, more than 10 hours, since this is a complicated bill, to review the bill. Will it be available to us and the public more than 10 hours before we have to vote for it? Since our leader has said, our Republican leader, that there'll be plenty of time for a process where people can make amendments, you need time to prepare those amendments.
I think we'll have ample opportunity to read and amend the bill.
Will it be more than 10 hours?
We'll have ample opportunity to read and amend the bill.
I rest my case.
He rests his case. Well, we won't let it happen without at least journalistic light to the extent anything can be pried open. Health care and stealth care are among the big issues in another big thing happening today. That special election is underway in Tom Price and Newt Gingrich's old congressional district outside Atlanta, the special election that has become the most expensive congressional race in American history as it seeks to confirm or refute the Trump's policies and behaviors and things like stealth care that the Republican Congress are doing are acceptable or not in a rising swing district in this country. The polls are open until 7 o'clock tonight. There's the death of Otto Warmbier, the murder of an American student by the regime of North Korea. Murder, as John McCain directly put it, what to do about that? There's the first U.S. shootdown of a Syrian warplane during the Civil War era and Russia's threat to shoot down American planes that cruise that airspace again. A Russian plane just did buzz an American one a short time ago. That's a little breaking news. There's the attack on innocent Muslims minding their own business coming out of a mosque in London. Radical anti-Islamic terrorism in a car on the sidewalk attack designed to mimic ISIS. There's the ruling by the Supreme Court that the unjustified imprisonment and brutality against American Muslims in Brooklyn after 9/11 cannot result in a damage suit against the officials responsible. Former Attorney General Ashcroft and former FBI Director Robert Mueller. Wait, don't I know that name from somewhere? And there is confirmation of something that was not known for sure until yesterday. Jared Kushner can speak. He made his first comments before cameras and an open microphone yesterday since the Trump administration took office at a White House tech summit.
Before I came to Washington, many warned me that the bureaucracy would resist any change that we tried to implement. So far, I have found exactly the opposite. To date, we've been working with hundreds of talented civil servants, men and women, who want to serve their country and see their government do better.
And then he went on to take questions. Oh, no, he didn't. Kushner spoke because reorganizing the federal government consistent with the principles of business management as part of Kushner's assignment in his father-in-law's administration, along with a few other things, including diplomacy with Mexico, diplomacy with China, solving the opioid epidemic, reforming the criminal justice system, reforming care for veterans, and negotiating Middle East peace, and the management of an evolving team of private lawyers as the government assesses his secret contacts last year with Russian officials and a Kremlin-linked banker whose bank is under U.S. sanctions and failing to disclose any of it on his security clearance application when he signed on for these little government jobs. Maybe that's one of the ways he's bringing principles of business management to the public sector. And that brings us to our first two guests for today in an expanded green space edition of our series, Trusha Daily. Excuse me, every day for the month of June, we are following the Trump world and Russia developments. Kushner's evolving legal team is one of them today. We have two special guests, former Brooklyn DA and Watergate-era Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman and the Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen, expert on all things Putin and all things authoritarian and totalitarian, Elizabeth Holtzman first. Welcome back to WNYC. So nice to have you in the green space.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Can we talk some history for people who only vaguely know what Watergate was? People may know that Nixon resigned in the summer of 1974, but not know that during that same summer, the House Judiciary Committee that you were on held actual impeachment hearings. Were there specific charges against Nixon that you were considering?
Not only did we consider them, but we voted for them. He was, the House Judiciary Committee voted on a bipartisan basis after very lengthy deliberations and with full public scrutiny to impeach Richard Nixon on three basic charges, three articles of impeachment. The first article of impeachment was basically the cover-up of the Watergate break-in that he orchestrated and had many components, suborning perjury, firing the special prosecutor, finding out from the Justice Department what their investigations were finding out, and then telling witnesses about it. It had a lot of components, getting the CIA to stop the FBI investigation. That was Article 1. Article 2 was an abuse of power article, and it ranged, it included some of the abuses of power that were involved in the cover-up, but it went way beyond that. It started with the break-in in Dr. Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, which was condoned, ratified, and supported by Richard Nixon.
That was after he leaked the Pentagon Papers?
Yeah, and Nixon wanted to get Ellsberg. That was one of the things he did. Nixon also started illegal wiretaps, and he kept the wiretap records, we believe, in his own office. He wiretapped members of the White House staff, which was particularly handy-dandy when one of them went to work for his presidential opponent so he could find out what was going on in his opponent's campaign. Those wiretaps had nothing to do with the good of the American people or the country. We also had an enemies list. Some people in this room will remember that. Richard Nixon said, aha, people oppose my policies on the Vietnam War, which I'm keeping going no matter what, I'm going to get their tax returns audited. So these are some of the things. There were many, many articles, charges in each of the articles of impeachment. The third article was that Richard Nixon obstructed our investigation into impeachment by refusing to turn over tape recordings and other documents.
So there were things.
So it was not just a third-rate burglary. Watergate is really kind of an umbrella term that covers dozens and dozens of actions by the President of the United States that were criminal, that were quasi-criminal, that were abuses of power. And when I say criminal, you also ought to know that the grand jury that was investigating Watergate and indicted all of Nixon's top aides and two attorneys general, Mitchell and Kleindienst, wanted to indict Richard Nixon. And they were persuaded by the special prosecutor that a president couldn't be indicted. So he was named by the grand jury as an unindicted co-conspirator, the first and only president of the United States. So this was not some third-rate burglary, some minor matter, some trivial footnote to our history. This was a president engaged in major and persistent and systematic wrongdoing.
And there's so much more there that you just went through than most people know. They probably think that it wasn't just the third-rate burglary. It was the cover-up of the third-rate burglary and the obstruction of justice on the way to covering up the third-rate burglary. But what you've just described is so much more than that, things that had nothing to do with the burglary or the cover-up.
Correct. But they all had to do with a central premise of Richard Nixon's presidency, which was the right to be above the law, whether it included breaking into people's homes, illegally wiretapping them, misusing the powers of his office to protect himself and his aides from criminal accountability. It was the idea that the president, uber alles, the president above the law. And that's what happened in Watergate. He was held accountable.
Now, impeachment is the equivalent of an indictment. The House does that. Then the Senate holds the equivalent of a trial and votes to actually remove the president from office or not. Clinton was impeached, but not removed. Did Nixon resign because he came to see his impeachment and removal as inevitable and resigning was a little less humiliating?
I think that that's a fair statement. The fact of the matter is that the House Judiciary Committee voted on an overwhelming basis for these three articles of impeachment. And it was a bipartisan vote. It wasn't just one token Republican or two token Republicans. There were seven Republicans who supported the impeachment of the president on Article II, and I think six on Article I. So it was a substantial number. You had also all of the Southern Democrats on the committee, and they had districts that were as conservative, if not more conservative, than some of the Republican districts. So every Democrat plus a substantial number of Republicans voted for this. One of the things that caused Nixon to resign was the fact that the Supreme Court had decided that he had to release tape recordings that he had made to the grand jury. And President Nixon had, for some reason, decided to put a tape recording system into the Oval Office. And it was voice activated, so every conversation was recorded. And one of the main charges against him was that he had been told about the cover-up by John Dean, his White House counsel. And Dean said the burglars who broke in are being paid hush money, and not to tell about the higher-ups who were involved, and they're being offered presidential pardons. And when Nixon and Dean testified to this before the Senate, Dean said, well, when I told the president that we needed more money, the president, instead of saying, get out of here, let's stop this, said, oh, I know where you could get money for it. And Nixon, of course, said, I never said that. And Dean said, yes, he said that. And, of course, the tape recordings would show who was telling the truth. Well, Nixon didn't want the truth to come out, so he fired a special prosecutor. Do we hear some resonances of today? He fired the special prosecutor, or had a special prosecutor fired. And he fought the release of the tapes. When the tapes were ordered released by a unanimous Supreme Court, including Republican judges, justices who had been appointed by Richard Nixon, Berger and Blackmun, everybody voted to release these tapes despite the president's claim of executive privilege. The tapes showed, guess what? That Richard Nixon, in his own voice, was orchestrating the cover-up. From the get-go, he said to his top aide, Haldeman, you could hear it on the tapes, Haldeman, you call the CIA and get them to stop the FBI investigation into Watergate.
Pretty direct.
And it's right on the tapes. So at that point, all of the Republican holdouts who said, no evidence, we don't have evidence. Of course, we had a lot of evidence, including Haldeman's own notes of these conversations that said this very thing. And Dean's testimony, okay, but with the tape, every single holdout Republican, including the most conservative, said Richard Nixon should be impeached. Mm. When you had a unanimous House Judiciary Committee saying that the President of the United States was going to be impeached, you knew that the vote in the House of Representatives, if there were five people supporting Richard Nixon, that would be a lot, and that he would lose in the Senate.
listeners your questions for former Brooklyn Congresswoman, former Brooklyn DA, Elizabeth Holtzman, about yesterday or today or the relationship between them. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. People here in the green space, you can raise your hand and we'll come around. And on that eerie resonance on the firing of the special prosecutor, just staying on the history for a second, what was Nixon's public excuse for firing Archibald Cox, and why did he think that wouldn't be political suicide?
Well, you know, I don't know what was going on in Richard Nixon's mind. I couldn't put myself into his brain for one second. But it's quite clear that if the tapes had been released, that would have been the death knell for him. He knew that, so he was going to do anything that he could to avoid it.
The wall.
I actually don't remember what argument he used, but he probably said, you know, he's got no right to seek these tapes. This is executive. These are my presidential documents, recordings, and I'm going to stop him from doing that. But the firing of Archibald Cox and the important thing, the special prosecutor, the important thing is that that was the death knell for Richard Nixon in the sense that that is what triggered impeachment. Let's go back and talking history. The break-in at Watergate, and we still don't know whether Nixon directly orchestrated it, but I'll get to that point later. But in any case, that took place in June, just the 17th of June, so we just passed that anniversary, 1972. The cover-up was so effective that Nixon was reelected by one of the biggest landslides in history that November. June break-in, huge cover-up, November, huge re-election victory. That starts to unravel. And by the time, and by October of 1973, Dean has testified as White House counsel about the cover-up, a cancer on the presidency, and he told the president. There were his Nixon fired his two top staff aides. Others had reported about the cover-up. And so when President Nixon fired the special prosecutor who was investigating the break-in and the cover-up, the American people, and remember, most of them had voted for him. Most of them had voted for him that November, and we're not talking about October. They said, you know something? We're not a banana republic. The president of the United States cannot fire the prosecutor who's investigating him. And the American people stood up and demanded congressional action. The firing of the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, for trying to seek the presidential tapes, triggered the House Judiciary Committee's impeachment investigation. And from that point on, it was just a steady march to his impeachment.
And as a footnote, the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General at the time refused to fire Cox. It fell to Nixon's Solicitor General, a guy named Robert Bork, who of course was later nominated for the Supreme Court by Ronald Reagan and rejected as too radical and to many people too racist. Do you think the lessons of that history make it politically impossible for Trump to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller?
No.
Why?
Why? Because we don't always learn from history. I mean, if we learned from history, the American people wouldn't be electing Donald Trump to begin with, in my opinion. But secondly, he wouldn't be engaging in activities that could create this kind of miasma and this kind of problem. I think the firing of Comey, the firing of the FBI director. I mean, I was in Congress when we enacted the legislation to try to create an independent FBI director, somebody who would have a 10-year term so the president wouldn't be politically accountable to the president, and yet a 10-year term meaning it couldn't be like J. Edgar Hoover and be there forever. I know what was going on in our minds, and yet here we have the president of the United States firing the head of the FBI, a lot like the firing of Cox, because of the investigation that he was conducting. Well, the president of the United States is not above the law. He cannot determine who is going to investigate him or his staff or his campaign aides, and he can't determine that outcome.
Now, Trump's recent tweet suggests he's trying to draw a distinction between this situation and Watergate. One of his points is that Comey told him he was not under investigation, by Comey at the time he fired Comey. Cox was clearly investigating Nixon. How much does that exonerate Trump, in your opinion?
Not at all. Because even if he's not protecting himself, he can't protect the people around him. And it's quite clear that they were being investigated. President of the United States is not above the law and cannot dictate to the systems of justice that we have in place who is going to be held accountable and in what manner. That's what President Nixon tried to do. That was part of both articles of impeachment, removing the special prosecutor. It was an abuse of the power of his office because he wasn't using the power of his office for the benefit of the people of the United States. He was using the power of his office to protect himself and his aides. That's what it was about, because ultimately he was worried, I guess, if he got his aides, they might say something about him, and it could be incriminating for him. So I don't think there's any real issue here about deep and serious presidential misconduct and Donald Trump's failure to understand the history and the significance of Watergate.
Let's take a phone call. Monica in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Monica. Monica, are you there? I'm not sure if she's not there or having trouble bringing up the phones. Let me try Susan in Long Island City and see if we can hear her. Susan, are you there? All right, we're going to work on the phone connection to the green space. Who here has a question? Anybody with a hand raised? We'll bring the microphone around right away. Who's got the microphone? Okay, right over there as we're passing it down. Hi there.
Hi. So given your knowledge and experience, can you give us some idea of what you think the future is going to bring with Donald Trump? And it's not only firing the Comey, it's the money situation and interweaving all his money with, I mean, there's a million things. So how do we get him out?
Well, let's put it this way. You don't just get somebody out. I think the other thing we have to think about is, for better or worse, we have a constitutional democracy. President is there for 4 years. He's elected for a 4-year term. But the framers understood. They might not have known whether his name was Nixon or his name was Trump, but they knew that presidents in the future were going to do very bad things. So they did prescribe the power of impeachment to remove a president who is danger. You have to have grounds. You have to have a basis. You can't just say, this president is is horrific, which he is, in my opinion. You have to have a legal basis, a constitutional basis to remove him, and it can't be frivolous. So what do I think? I think it's critical to have the investigation. I think Mr. Mueller is conducting an investigation into what I would call two aspects of what Trump is doing, and there may be more, because there are a lot of things, as you mentioned, out there. One is related to the firing of Comey. Was that an obstruction of justice under the federal statutes? That itself, there's some evidence at this point that suggests seriously that this was an obstruction of justice, but he hasn't finished his investigations because he's going to talk to Mr. Coates, and he's going to talk to Admiral Rogers, and he's going to find out whether Trump told them to call Comey and get him to stop the investigation. Because if he did that, then you have a pretty good case. There may be some other. Was never a federal prosecutor, so I'm not an expert on obstruction of justice laws. But there may be other people in the White House that he spoke with and other aides who could confirm and support these charges. Then you also have the charges that deal with, why was he obstructing this investigation? What was his motivation? Was it to cover up? What was he trying to cover up? What was he trying to protect here? Was he trying to protect collusion by his staff with the Russians over the electronic break-in to the DNC? Or was he trying to protect his financial interests? We don't know very much about that, except we do know that some of his very top campaign aides and top advisors were dealing with the Russians frequently. So what is that all about? So I think Comey's looking at that. That's a very, that Mueller, could be a difficult investigation.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show, live from the Green Space today. My special guest, former Brooklyn DA, former Brooklyn Congresswoman, Among many other things, Elizabeth Holtzman, 212-433-WNYC. Now, you wrote a book in 2006 called The Impeachment of George W. Bush, A Practical Guide for Concerned Citizens. We talked about it on the air at the time. People have a gauzy view now of how nice and straightforward President Bush was. But does your book also indicate that partisan politics have reached the point where you called for the impeachment of not just Trump under these circumstances, or I don't know if you're calling for his impeachment now, or at least the investigation, but you know, he's someone who is seen so widely as an outlier, but also of Bush, who is now seen as a more normal Republican president. Is that an indication of the level of partisanship in the country in the last decade and more?
Well, my views, I think, were shaped by my experience on the House Judiciary Committee. I mean, I was a brand new member of Congress. I was a lawyer. I never studied. I went to Harvard Law School. We never studied the impeachment clause of the Constitution. I didn't know anything about it. But what I learned and experienced during the impeachment process against Richard Nixon made me very sensitive to the issue of abuses of power. And with regard to President Bush, while he may seem to be, in some respects, more normal than Donald Trump, the fact of the matter is that he took us into a war without, by deception and by lies to the Congress and the American people. He authorized torture of people abroad in apparently direct violation of U.S. statutes. So these are extremely serious things that were done and need to be understood. Now, I was calling for an investigation because I thought these charges should be investigated, and I do believe that the charges against Donald Trump need to be investigated. That's what I think is critical. One of the reasons we were able in the House Judiciary Committee to put the case together was because you had a Senate Watergate committee headed by Sam Ervin, a constitutional scholar from North Carolina, and Howard Baker, a moderate Republican. And basically, it started off pretty partisan, but it wound up compiling a huge evidentiary record against Richard Nixon. And then you had the special prosecutor. So by the time we came into being and in terms of an impeachment inquiry, we had all this background to help us determine whether there were charges. And when we first started the impeachment activity, I don't think anybody, there was no nose count. I was never asked how I was going to vote on impeachment because we hadn't started the effort. But we did have this background that it was helpful. Unfortunately, now it is so partisan that the House Intelligence Committee can't even get its act together. You have the head of the House Intelligence Committee trying to be a mouthpiece for Trump. So what kind of investigation could they have?
Devin Nunes.
Supposedly recused himself, and then he pulled himself back in. So that's nonsensical. The Senate committee is kind of plodding along. At least it's plodding in the kind of right direction. But I don't think we have anything that we saw during the Watergate era where the Senate seriously undertook the investigation. Let me say the Senate Republican, Howard Baker, started off being a total partisan for Richard Nixon. He said, you know, I'm going to ask this question. What did the president know and when did he know it? Became two very famous questions because he thought nobody could connect Richard Nixon to any of the obstruction of justice, any of the cover-up. But he was wrong, and he saw that. And so he became, I wouldn't say an advocate for impeachment, but an advocate for getting to the truth.
Let's take another question over here. You had somebody over here? No? Okay, who wants to put up a hand and pass that microphone right down there? And hi there.
Hi. I remember Watergate very well. And one of the differences, I think, between then and now has to do with the 24/7 news cycle, and we're constantly bombarded with news of everything. Back then, we all kind of watched the same networks, read a lot of the same things. So I wonder if you think that difference between then and now has any impact on what's going on.
Are you thinking, ma'am, that it makes it harder or easier to get to the truth, or what's behind your question?
Well, I don't know if it makes it harder to get to the truth, but it makes it harder for all of us to kind of get to the truth. I don't think it might not make it harder for the committees to get to the truth and so on. It might make it harder for all of us to get to the truth. And also the impact
because we're every day, we hear every single thing that's been leaked, every single thing that's going on. And as I said, back then, we were all kind of listening mostly to the same news outlets. We were all getting the same news together. And I think it might have made it easier for us to, you know, follow the steps and realize what was happening.
You know, I'm not an expert on this, so I can't really answer that question. I guess we'll see what difference it makes now. But I just know that, if I can step back, that the press played a crucial role. Woodward and Bernstein, they were both young reporters. They didn't, you know, they just followed their nose in the investigation, and they did an amazingly important job. I know that when we started our impeachment activities, we mostly were behind closed doors, and we were behind closed doors for about 3 or 4 months. And we were being attacked daily by the press. Why aren't you making what's going on public? Why are you doing this? Are you just stalling? Are you just delaying? I mean, it was very hard. And then we finally had public hearings. Basically, the powers that be in the House did not want public hearings of the Judiciary Committee because they thought people would grandstand. But some of the younger members said, you know, if the American people can't see what's happening, they're not going to accept any verdict that we issue. So they've got to see the debate. They've got to see who the members are. They've got to hear it. And even if they don't understand everything, they can make a judgment about the sincerity, the intelligence, the thoughtfulness of what people are saying. And that's exactly what happened. I don't know that the news cycle will interfere here or won't interfere. What concerns me is the partisanship and the failure in the House to take its job seriously of conducting investigations. And I hope the Senate is going to be on the right track, but I don't know for sure.
As an addendum, we turn back the clock to a little later in 1974. Nixon had already resigned from office. His successor, President Gerald Ford, had pardoned him. And Ford came before the House Judiciary Committee and was questioned about the pardon by Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman.
Mr. Ford, you stated that the theory on which you pardoned Richard Nixon was that he had suffered enough. And I'm interested in that theory because the logical consequence of that is that somebody who resigns in the face of virtually certain impeachment or somebody who is impeached should not be punished because the impeachment or the resignation in face of impeachment is punishment enough. And I wondered whether anybody had brought to your attention the fact that the Constitution specifically states that even though somebody is impeached, that person shall nonetheless be liable to punishment according to law.
Mrs. Holtzman, I was fully cognizant of the fact that the President, on resignation, was accountable for any criminal charges. But I would like to say that the reason I gave the pardon was not as to Mr. Nixon himself. I repeat, and I repeat with emphasis, the purpose of the pardon was to try and get the United States, the Congress, the President, and the American people focusing on the serious problems we have both at home and abroad.
So a last word on that or anything, and one thing that's extraordinary about that, listening to me, is just that the President of the United States came before a House hearing.
Well, he was, I mean, I have to say, yes, that was a gesture of openness, but in fact, it was a gesture to make sure that nobody asked any tough questions because nobody on the House Judiciary Committee subcommittee, of which I was a member, asked a single tough question of the President, and I went on to ask the President of the United States whether there was a deal with respect to the pardon, which would have created a real issue of its validity, and a number of other questions. So, yes, it created the appearance of openness, but in fact, it was a way of ensuring that there was no serious investigation, and there never was, of this pardon. And I think it was an unpardonable pardon because it created a dual system of justice in this country for presidents who engage in serious misconduct, including criminal misconduct. And you might ask President Ford, if he was so concerned about what the good of the American people, why he actually was going to give President Nixon all of the documents so that we could, it would have affected the prosecutions of his aides, it would have affected history, it would have affected our ability to understand what was going on. So there were some things that he did, President Ford, that were not consistent with the idea that he was helping the American people move on, which is a questionable objective anyway.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Elizabeth Holtzman.